Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Infrastructure. For most of us, it means roads, bridges, culverts, sewer and water pipes. But what about trees? Some New England scientists now say trees should be considered infrastructure too. Look at all the trees do, they argue, cleaning the water and air, providing flood control and soil stability. Never mind attracting tourists the world over who come to see our famed fall foliage. So if trees are infrastructure, New Hampshire seems like it should be in pretty good shape, with more than 80% of our land forested. But there are several important species that have faced huge struggles: the elm, the ash, and the American chestnut. Today in The Exchange, with foliage season underway, we look at troubled trees, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Also on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, there's a lot more information and some great pictures, so check that out too as you listen. Our guests for the hour are Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Society for Protection of New Hampshire Forests, co-host of NHPR Something Wild. And Dave, it's always great to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Jeff Garnas, Assistant Professor of Forest Ecosystem Health at the Department of Natural Resources and the Environment at UNH. And Jeff, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Also with us, Christian Marks, ecologist with the Nature Conservancy's Connecticut River Program, where he studies floodplain forests and is collaborating with the Forest Service to develop American elms with a greater tolerance to Dutch elm disease. And Christian, it's really good to have you too. Thank you for making the trip.
Thank you.
So before we jump into these three species, guys, again, the elm, the ash, and a little bit later, the American chestnut. Dave, we really should just get a foliage update from you. Here we are, just before the big Columbus Day weekend. People are probably already streaming into the state. How good a show are those 9 million visitors that are predicted going to get?
9.75 million visitors and $1.5 billion over the course of the fall foliage season. So it's tremendously important to tourism. The most popular destinations tend to be in the White Mountains and the Lakes region, but the colors have started to come on a little bit stronger in central New Hampshire in the past week. You know, it was kind of an early start because we had a cool Labor Day weekend. People were wearing sweatshirts over Labor Day weekend. People were surprised by early color in September way in the North Country, north of the Notches and up in Cowas County. And then we had a heat wave.
Summer came back.
Right. Slowed things down. People began to say to me, when are the leaves going to change? Well, look, as long as there's green leaves on the trees in September, there's going to be foliage in October. You know, people look at trees on their front lawn and street trees, and some of those are impacted by things like fungus or black tar spot and maples. And then they extrapolate that to say, oh, no. But I mean, we look at our backyard tree, we look at the street trees, and we think about forest health and an individual tree. And then we try to extrapolate that to the entire forest. I will say the foliage is going to be excellent this year. And it's just coming on. It was early, then it slowed down, and now it's kind of right on schedule. It's a little early, but also Columbus Day is early this year, too.
That's true. So I'm kind of laughing because before the program, I said to you, hey, the tree in my backyard, right, doesn't look so good as I think it should this time of year. So that's how people judge it. You know, if you haven't had a chance to get out and
I think locals actually sin by comparing years this year to past years. I mean, people compared to the rest of the world, if you see any foliage like we have, we take it for granted. It's a spectacular natural phenomenon. People don't look at the aurora borealis and say, well, it wasn't quite as good in terms of the colors of the aurora that I saw 10 years ago. Look, if you see it, it's amazing. And so this is going to be a great foliage year.
So people do focus a lot on the weather. And you hinted at that, Dave. You know, in a wet year, they'll say, oh, it was wet this year, the foliage won't be any good. Or last year it was, oh, it was dry this year, the foliage isn't going to be any good. How does the weather affect the color that we see?
Well, it affects how brilliant the foliage is. Some years are more brilliant and vibrant colors with a lot of sunshine, and cool nights and bright sunny days is great for foliage. Following a summer without too much rain, which gives fungus the upper hand, or a summer that was too dry like last summer, because sometimes that, you know, dries out the foliage. And last year's foliage was excellent, even despite predictions that the drought was going to affect it. It was a great year. This year we had a great setup. We had a nice summer, not too hot, not too cold, not too wet, not too dry. So it was looking pretty good. So in addition to weather, there's also the site that the trees are growing. There's, you know, forest health considerations, and then there's individual trees. And people want to see one tree and then, you know, make a conclusion about the whole forest.
Well, that's the thing. You've written, Dave, that, you know, trees have stresses that they're under, and sometimes that affects the color.
Right. And all you have to do is look at a swamp or a beaver pond and see how early red maples lose their leaves in response to having wet feet all the time. They're stressed out. They're the last ones to leaf out. They're the first ones to lose their leaves in the fall. And so we expect red maples to turn in September. I'd say the red maples are a little late this year, but they're coming on. I drove by some beautiful wetlands this morning and see a lot of color coming in the red maple. Like I said, as long as there's green leaves, there's going to be foliage in October.
What's the funniest question you've ever gotten about foliage? Oh, you've written a lot about
right?
this.
There's so, you know, I think the fun thing I have is people who are so obsessed with the idea of peak foliage. Like, they have to catch this perfect moment of peak foliage. And I used to joke and say, what if it comes in the middle of the night? Can you, you know, race down a Keene and catch it before it leaves the state? You know, one, the other question that I really like is how long will it last? And so we're, you know, in good weather, it can last for more than a week to 10 days of really, really peak colors over a long period of time. It all depends on the weather. Again, if we get rain and wind and a tropical storm, you know, doing its thing over New Hampshire in mid-October, that can foreshorten the season. We had an extended season last year, and there's every reason to expect we could have a good extended foliage season this year.
Well, the number again for you to join us here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, with foliage season underway, as Dave reminds us, we're looking at three important species to our region and the stresses that they have faced. We'll also hear about restoration efforts for them. There's a lot going on. The three species are elm, ash, and the American chestnut. Join us with your observations and questions, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, gentlemen, transitioning to our main subject today, and that's efforts to bolster these three species that I mentioned. Let's start with the elm tree. And Christian Marks, the words people use to describe this tree, majestic, iconic, magnificent, what was it about the elm that just made people go, wow?
Yeah, like you're hinting, it wasn't the wood which attracts us to a lot of species. In the case of the elm, what made it so popular was it was just a very beautiful tree and ideal as a shade tree around houses before there was air conditioning. They had those long arching branches. And as a street tree, the same thing. These branches would touch over the two sides of the street and create the impression of a vaulted ceiling like in a Gothic cathedral. And people just fell in love with that and planted them all over New England towns. And, you know, we all have seen all the elm streets and the town commons had them. And so the older people that remember the elms very much feel a nostalgia for that part of our cultural heritage.
So very tall, very graceful, offering fantastic shade.
Yes.
And the word iconic is sometimes overused, but you're right. There are a lot of main streets in New Hampshire that are called Elm Street, like in Manchester, for example. And that's why. So yeah. That speaks to the importance of these trees.
Yeah, so about 100 years ago when Dutch elm disease arrived and these trees started dying, it was very sad because they were so prominent. You know, it's one thing when a tree dies in the middle of the woods where no one sees it, but if it's the tree in front of your house, it really affects people.
Right, or that beautiful tree in the park downtown or wherever it may be. Do you want to jump in a little bit, Jeff, to just how important these trees were to people here in New Hampshire?
Absolutely. I think mostly, as it was just said, it's a function of people planting them in their yards and having them planted along tree-lined streets in really much of the East, including the Northeast, and then watching them just go away. Unfortunately, people maybe over-relied on elm a bit because it is such a beautiful tree and it was widely, widely planted, but that unfortunately reduces the diversity and makes it much more susceptible to a single pathogen that can come in and then wipe out the whole of a resource rather than just a few trees here and there.
Yeah. So, Christian, what happened?
There were some infected logs that were imported into New York Harbor and to a mill in Ohio. And so the logs had larvae of the bark beetles that spread Dutch elm disease. They were imported from Europe, where the disease is actually not native either. And then all along that route, the bark beetles emerged and then infected local elm trees. The American elm was highly susceptible to the fungal pathogen that the bark beetles were spreading. And initially, it was mostly around New York, but then in the 1938 hurricane, knocked down a lot of elm trees. And all that dead wood was perfect habitat for the bark beetle larvae. And so the bark beetle population exploded. And then, you know, on the predominant winds that are westerly, went further into New England. And by the 1950s, the elms were dying all over New England.
That's amazing. So this is the 1930s, mostly Ohio and then New York. But the hurricane of 38 created a perfect sort of buffet for these beetles.
Yes, in Connecticut. And then it just, once you had that bark beetle population big, it created its own momentum. A lot of bark beetles infected a lot of trees. A lot of trees died, which increased more dead wood for the bark beetles. And so it became self-perpetuating once it got going.
That's a downward spiral. Go ahead, Jeff. You want to jump in?
Well, I was reading last night, and Christian can correct me if I'm wrong, but also part of the story was there was quite an extensive effort to suppress the spread of the disease and the beetles around the late 30s, but then World War II came, and that took a lot of resources away in terms of labor from the effort to contain the populations within the New York City area, and that also facilitated the spread.
Wow, fascinating. And David, love your thoughts, too, on just what these trees meant to us here in New Hampshire and how their decline was pretty rapid, really, when you look at it.
Well, you hear about, you know, the street tree value of them in places like Keene, New Hampshire, which is Elm City, and Elm Street in Manchester, but they're also important ecologically because they tended to occupy, along with a suite of other species, the floodplain forests. So they have an important function in terms of the hydrology and holding the banks and being part of a native forest community that includes a suite of trees and understory plants and the animals that are also reliant upon those trees. So we try to imagine what the forest might have looked like, gallery forests along our rivers and streams 400 years ago, and we have to kind of use our imagination. So there's a host of other interactions between, you know, elm trees and green ash trees and silver maple forests that are riparian species that are adapted to grow in those rich sites.
Riparian means what, Dave?
Along the river.
Along the river. Yeah, go ahead, Christian.
And that is actually what got me interested into the American elm, working on conservation of floodplain forest along the Connecticut River. I was studying these forests to find ways to restore them and protect them in strategic ways because of all the great things they do for people, such as reducing flood hazard and reducing the excess nutrients in the river. And as I was studying them, I had gone in thinking of them as silver maple forests. And the understory still has a lot of American elms in it. And it's actually the second most common tree in the floodplain forest after silver maple even today. except that the trees are very small. They're only about 3-4 inches in diameter, and then they get the disease. So whereas they were dominant canopy trees in the past, like Dave was saying, today they're these small understory trees. They reproduce early. They produce seed at a young age, so they're able to have seedlings there before they die, and the seedlings don't get the disease. So the disease kind of goes through these stream bank and floodplain areas in waves where, you know, every 20 years or so, there's a wave of Dutch elm disease going through as the next set of seedlings reaches the size that are attractive to bark beetles. And and so wanting to restore these communities, restoring that, it's kind of a keystone species in that community. And so that became a focus, and that's where we reached out to the U.S. Forest Service, who was working on American elm restoration, and began a partnership to accelerate this effort.
So, and two words that we'll probably use a lot this hour, understory, Jeff, and canopy. So just for the uninitiated, what are those?
Sure. Basically, that just refers to the understory being the plants that grow under the closed canopy of leaves at the top of tall trees, and then the canopy is basically the tops of trees that we think about over our head when we walk through the forest.
And it sounds like elms can't make it to that canopy level and get all the light and get even bigger.
Right. It's a similar story with the other species that we'll be talking about today, but elm has a period of resistance as it grows as a young tree growing vigorously. It also escapes by sheer luck to a degree. Eventually the trees are colonized and begin to die back.
Again, the number for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts, or memories of big elm trees. Maybe you saw some around you when you were younger. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Also, check out our website, nhpr.org/exchange. There's a lot more information there, also some great pictures of these trees. So check it out. And again, you can call us with your questions and comments right now at 1-800-892-6477. So Dave, a little bit more on what you said earlier, because I thought that was interesting. You know, people think about that big, beautiful elm tree in their backyard or, you know, on Elm Street and so forth, or in the park. But talk a little bit more, Dave, about the role that the elm tree plays in the natural ecosystem. Well, you know, what plants and animals depended on its existence.
Sure, Laura. And, you know, you think about street trees versus forest trees, and that's kind of an artificial distinction that we make. We've sort of adapted forest trees and planted them as landscape specimens because we like the way they look. The other thing that Jeff just mentioned I think is really important is the crisis is also an opportunity in that there are elms. I walked out my back door today and saw dozens of elm trees. I picked, you know, a piece of elm wood with leaves on it to bring in today. There are elms in the landscape. There are chestnuts in the landscape. Even with ash coming through, there may be some that have a little bit more tolerance, if not resistance, but not resistance to a bug, but tolerance to live with that disease affecting it. And that's also an opportunity because it gives geneticists an opportunity to look at why are certain trees seemingly more able to tolerate the effects of diseases. And that provides an opportunity to pursue things like restoration, like they've been working on with elm, with chestnut. The trees aren't all wiped out. That's what people tend to think. Oh my God, those are all gone. No, they're there. They're just growing in the understory, and they never really reach what their potential would have been in the absence of the disease vectors that are taking them out when they're adults.
But the fact that they're there in the understory, even in those small sizes that Christian describes, you know, gives us some reason to hope.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, porcupines love elm trees. And I actually find elm trees in the fall by looking at branches that are broken off and just defoliated by the local plague of porcupines we have.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Krishna, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what I just asked Dave. You know, why, beyond that they're beautiful and we love them, why is it important for elms to survive?
In the natural habitat, in the floodplain, like Dave was hinting at, the elm can co-evolve with the pathogen, whereas an urban tree can't do that. It's not reproducing. You can't have natural selection on the offspring for greater resistance. So the restoration of the species in the wild is an important part of the solution to make it sustainable. Because if we just select a disease-tolerant tree and we clone it and they're all genetically identical and we plant them in an urban area, eventually the pathogen will find a way around that defense and we'll be back where we started.
That's really interesting. So we can't just sort of scrub up a couple trees and say, you're fixed, because eventually the pathogen will find its way back. So you need diversity.
Exactly. You need to find multiple genotypes that are resistant or highly tolerant, put them in the wild, have them reproducing together, and hopefully some of their offspring are even more tolerant. And then as the disease goes through, it will select for those. And then it becomes the way that native diseases are in the forest, where they'll take out the weak individuals, but the species are thriving. And in the native region of where Dutch elm disease comes from in Eastern Asia and Eastern Russia, those elm species are resistant to the Dutch elm disease.
Takes time. It's frustrating to watch, but go ahead.
Yeah, so those trees will display some symptoms, but it doesn't really affect them much. And hopefully we can get there with our species as well.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I just think it's more important to note that with all of these trees, again, that we're talking about, each one has a unique value to the landscape in terms of its ecology and the way that it interacts with the invertebrates and the vertebrate mammals and other animals in the forest, as well as with people, of course. But so anytime we lose a species or seriously reduce its abundance in the forest, we're also influencing lots of other things that co-occur with it. For example, with ash anyway, there's at least 45, probably up to 100 specialist insects that occur on ash. The very similar story with chestnut. I'm not as familiar with elm to know the numbers, but anytime you wipe out a species to that degree, you're reducing the abundance of lots of other things that co-occur with it, including insects, but also birds and mammals. Elm doesn't have as quite as important of a nut crop, so it's not affecting the vertebrates quite as much. But certainly things like nutrient cycling and hydrology can change drastically when you change the species composition.
Go ahead. Did you want to jump back in, Christian?
I just wanted to add to what Jeff was saying about some of the unique ecological functions of elm with respect to sustaining other species. As people in New Hampshire know, we have a spring freshet where the snow melt drives a flood in the low-lying wet areas along all our streams and rivers. And that freshet deposits sediments in the floodplain. So any species that would drop seed there in the fall, those sediments would get buried and they wouldn't be able to make it and they'd be underwater for a while, so the seed would die. So all of the floodplain species produce their seed in the spring, and it coincides with the receding floodwater when they disperse. So American elm actually flowers in March, and sometimes even in a really warm year like last year in February, and then its seed disperses in May. And the other floodplain species that live even lower in the floodplain, like cottonwood, in June. And so this provides seeds for various animals at a time of year when there are no other seeds around, especially these birds and small granivores.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, so playing a very important role in the ecosystem in ways that most of us don't even begin to notice. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and a little bit later we'll turn our attention to two other species, the ash tree and then the American chestnut. Efforts continue to bring it back. We'll find out a lot more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, troubled trees. With foliage season underway, we're looking at three important regional species, why they matter, what threats they face, and ongoing restoration efforts. The three species are elm, ash, and American chestnut. We've been talking about the elm tree. We will wrap that up, and then we will turn to the ash tree. And as we do, I really encourage you to go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. There's a lot more information there, some great pictures. So check it out, take a look, and of course, call us with your questions, comments, and your observations. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Dave Anderson with the Forest Society, co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. Also, Jeff Garnas. He's at UNH, where he's an assistant professor of forest ecosystem health. And also with us from Massachusetts, Christian Marks. He's an ecologist with the Nature Conservancy's Connecticut River Program and an expert on efforts to support and restore the American elm. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go right to our listeners. And John joins us from Colebrook. Hi, John. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
This is John Harrigan. I have to say hi, Dave, because I know Dave.
Hi, John.
So I thought your listeners would be interested to know, Laura, that back in 1876, there was a national movement to plant elms. And elm tree saplings were made available to towns at a ridiculously cheap price. And many towns went for the deal and planted elms all up and down their major streets. Colebrook was one of them. And when I was a kid, every thoroughfare, every street in town had a line of very stately, mature elm trees. And the reason they were so beautiful as a shade tree is they were the classic shape of a shade tree, the way people thought a shade tree should look. A big, tall stem starting out very wide at the bottom and sort of slendering a little bit as it went up, and then burgeoning at the top with this beautiful canopy, a perfect shade tree for downtowns. The problem was that when the Dutch elm disease got loose, it hit us, of course, too. We're not immune from any of society's ills.
So, John, what did Colebrook, you know, like so many other cities, you know, Keene and Manchester, did Colebrook plant something else once the elms went away?
No, it was worse than that. At that time, some research began, of course, furiously, and there was, in fact, a way to treat elm trees to prevent them from dying, and it worked, but it cost money, and it was figured at the time at about 50 cents a tree. And Colebrook, you know, using the rationale, I guess, that, well, you know, what the heck, there are trees all around us, which there are, said, no, I'm not going to pay. So the trees died, and the place looked like it was denuded, which
oh,
it was.
Boy. Well.
But it's even worse than that, because when the JCs, a young men's organization back then called the JCs, went around town offering people free saplings and free planting of other species of shade trees, they got a lot, mostly refusals, because people didn't want to rake the leaves. How about that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, John, it's great to hear from you, as always. And what do you think about this story, Dave? It's fascinating.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. But if people want to see beautiful, mature elms, they can go to Hanover, New Hampshire, on the campus of Dartmouth College. And they take a lot of care and time by inoculating those trees periodically and just watching those fastidiously to see any signs of Dutch elm disease. If they do, they prune those branches off. They burn that wood so it's not spreading the Dutch elm disease. But it's an expense, and it's an expense that some communities obviously are willing to undertake and other communities are not, but it requires constant vigilance. And if you want to see what Keene and Elm Street in Manchester or Main Street in Colebrook look like, you can go up to Hanover and look around the campus at Dartmouth College and beautiful elms up there.
Well, and thank you, John, again for the story. That's great. And this raises something, Christian, I know that you have thought about, which is, you know, sure, if you want to carefully tend a couple trees, elm trees, you can get them to grow. Your research, though, is let's have these thrive and survive in the wild, because that's really what's going to save this as a species more broadly.
Yes. So like the caller said, it's very expensive to treat these trees. So if you're in a place where the aesthetics is very important to you, you might do that. But of course, anywhere in the wild habitat, you can't afford to do that. So we need a more sustainable solution, and that will involve genetic resistance in the trees themselves.
And that's what you're working on at the Nature Conservancy.
Yes, it's a collaboration between the Nature Conservancy and the Forest Service, where we're breeding trees that have shown elevated levels of tolerance to Dutch elm disease and selecting the offspring for even more tolerance. So it's like classic crop breeding. You know, the world's food supply really depends on all these disease-resistant plant species, you know, varieties of crops. And so it certainly works there, and it can work in trees as well.
Well, again, John, thank you for the call. And let's take another one. This is Dick in Concord. Hi, Dick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking it, Laura.
Sure.
Hey, I just wondered if you would throw out the idea of these gosh darn caterpillars, which appear every fall and just seem to be everywhere. And I'll take the response from whoever off the air.
Well, I really appreciate the call. And you're right. Everybody loves to hate these, Dave.
So forest tent caterpillars defoliated some areas north of the White Mountains extensively. They show up almost every fall to a greater or lesser extent. Trees that are defoliated late in the growing season, that causes less damage because trees are getting ready to shut down. It's things that defoliate trees during June and July that are a little bit more serious.
So, I see.
I'd rather take a forest tent caterpillar infestation in my flowering crab trees in September than see gypsy moths defoliate in oak forest in June.
I see. So later in the season, they're getting ready to drop their leaves anyway. They say whatever.
They've already made their buds for next
sure.
year. So they don't re-leaf out the way that a defoliation in June will cause a tree to then form a second set of leaves in July and August, tax the tree, and then the buds for next year are much smaller.
Okay, that's interesting. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. That's 100% true. But I think what the caller may be referring to is something probably like the fall cankerworm or the forest tent caterpillars that are actually producing the silken cocoons or nests on the tips of trees, for
example. Yeah, you hate to see those.
Yeah, and so those are really unsightly, but absolutely from an ecological perspective, they're probably not that big of a deal, not really causing the trees that much trouble. But if people really don't like them and they can reach, you can cut them out, cut the nests out, and you sort of get rid of them for the season. But, of course, along the highway, you're not going to be able to do that on a large scale.
But it makes you feel better to do it, at least
sure.
for the tree, you know, around your own home. Thank you so much for that call, Dick. And to Priscilla in Greenland. Go ahead, Priscilla. You're on the air.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
No. Dudley. That's Dudley. I just wanted to say that I'm a major tree lover. And I grew up in Greenland on a road that was lined with sugar maples and elms. Of course, all the elms are gone. They've been gone for many, many years. But the ash trees here are beginning to die. As a matter of fact, this morning I was getting ready to call my tree guy to have him take down a very mature ash tree in my front yard. But around the corner at the Portsmouth Country Club, the whole lane is lined with beautiful horse chestnut trees. And I grew up here. And it pains me to see these trees dying. They're huge, and I've been going for years collecting those beautiful specimens and putting a bowl on my dining room table. They look like polished mahogany. And I don't know if there's anything you can do about any of this.
Well, I'm so glad you called, Priscilla, and good luck with Dudley. And I'm glad you called, especially because I did want to talk about ash trees, and that's your specialty, Jeff. So just remind us sort of where ash trees fit in the broader ecosystem, why they're important to us here in New Hampshire.
Sure. So nationally, there are 16 species of ash. In New Hampshire, we have primarily three, black, white, and green ash, and they have different ecological requirements or niches, we might call them. But they're not a dominant part of the forest in many places. About 6% of New Hampshire's trees are ash, but that accounts for about 25 million trees over a certain size class. 5 inches is the cutoff that the study used. And so they're quite important, both economically and ecologically, and they're widespread. They're a member of many, many forest communities. And they're also very important street trees.
Well, that's what I was going to ask too. Are they more widely seen/useful, for lack of a better word, as backyard trees, street trees, or are they more important in terms of a healthy forest ecosystem?
Well, they're certainly important in the forest ecosystem, but actually when elm was wiped out by Dutch elm disease, one of the main trees that was planted was ash. So especially green ash, but also white ash. Around the Concord area, you can see lots of places that are ash-lined streets that were probably once elm-lined streets. So absolutely, they're an important part of people's backyards and parks and streets.
Dave, go ahead.
And also, ash is a forest product. I mean, ash is incredibly important. Ash makes up about 6% of the native hardwood forests in New Hampshire. White ash is used for lumber, for tool handles, for baseball bats, for flooring.
Because it's really hard.
It's also beautiful. It's very clear wood. A lot of people like to burn ash for firewood. People don't burn elm for firewood. So ash is a really important species. And in fact, that led to the promulgation of the emerald ash borer when people were moving ash firewood around. So part of its demise came from its utility for firewood.
Well, I want to ask all of you about the emerald ash borer as well. But thank you, Priscilla, for the call. And again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. I also want to let everybody know that the guests today have brought in various little branches with leaves on them. So you can check out those pictures on Instagram at NHPR Exchange. Also, the web post today, our producers did a fantastic job. Lots of pictures and a lot more information. So check that out, nhpr.org/exchange. So yes, let's talk about the emerald ash borer. And this is a pretty, Jeff, right? A pretty recent threat.
Right. It was introduced, it was discovered in Michigan in 2002. It's probably been there since the mid-1990s. But it's only arrived in New Hampshire, as far as we know, in 2013. At the Steeplegate Mall was actually the ground zero in terms of where it was found. But it was most likely introduced into the Loudoun area, probably right around the Speedway is one of the strong hypotheses, and most likely as a function of people bringing firewood in for the campfires that they wanted to have around that facility.
So the emerald ash borer, it's this sort of emerald-colored bug, right? And it hangs out in the firewood. And if you travel from wherever to the Loudoun racetrack for the weekend, this is just a hypothesis. We don't know for sure. This thing, before you start your campfire and burn it, presumably, it creeps out and just starts to check out the neighborhood.
Right, exactly. So it's actually quite a beautiful insect. It's about half an inch long, bright emerald green. That's where it gets its name. It's a very shiny beetle. But it tends to feed in the high foliage, so you don't typically see it very readily. And then when it's in its larval stage, the adults lay eggs on the side of the tree, on the bark. And the larvae bore into the trees and spend their life inside the phloem, so you never see them. In fact, the first time that people typically start to recognize that their tree has been infested is when the woodpeckers come and start tearing off the bark to try to get at the larvae underneath.
I see.
It's a phenomenon called blonding because the side of the bark starts to turn kind of whitish as the woodpeckers pick off the moss and the older bark.
So how bad is it? It's a pretty recent phenomenon, this emerald ash borer. How much has it affected New Hampshire's ash trees so far?
Well, it's now in three counties all around the Concord area. So it was recently discovered in Stratford County. So that influences, obviously, quarantine boundaries. It's not made it up to the North Country yet. But it's since 2002, it's spread to 33 states in the U.S. So this thing is moving very quickly. It's likely to colonize much of the ash-dominated landscape in all of the country, really. There are strong efforts to try to contain it through quarantine and educational efforts in terms of asking people not to move firewood.
Sure. We've all seen those signs when we go camping.
As well as lots of quarantine regulations around how to move firewood or other kind of products from the infested zone and try to contain it there. And these programs have been effective at slowing the spread, we hope, but unfortunately it's not been successful in stopping it.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Dave, go ahead. You want to jump in?
Well, yeah, the campaign is Buy It Where You Burn It to prevent people from bringing in wood from elsewhere. But if you think about the fact that it was first detected in Detroit, Michigan in 2002 and then showed up in Concord, New Hampshire in March of 2013, it only took 11 years to go from the Great Lakes into New Hampshire. And it's still spreading. We learned at the end of September that it had been detected in Stratford County in New Durham and also in Stratford. And so they added Stratford County, to the other four counties, including Belknap County, Merrimack County, Hillsborough County, and Rockingham County that are under quarantine. And so it continues to spread. And so it's an expanding kind of ring of areas that are in infested areas and also potential expansion areas that are within 10 miles of that. So the area extends out from where it's currently and living in where I live in Sutton, knowing that it's in Hopkinton and knowing that Warner is right in between us and it's spreading towards Warner, it's really only a matter of time. It's kind of like watching a wave that's going to break over, you know, the ash forest where I live, white ash.
Christian, go ahead.
The recognition that it's very hard to contain the ash borer because it's a good flyer. And so the adults can disperse long distances, especially if, you know, they catch a favorable wind. You know, they can move about two towns. I've seen them move up the Connecticut River Valley from the Middletown, Connecticut area, about two towns a year. As people gave up on trying to contain it in Michigan, they started another strategy, which is biological control. In Asia, the Asian ash trees have some resistance to these larvae, but the other piece of it is that they are natural enemies that attack the larvae and keep their population down. And so these are little, they're in the wasp family, they're called parasitoids, and they will lay their eggs in the larvae, which kill the larvae. And there are three of those that are being released in the infested states to try to suppress the emerald ash borer.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because it's a little unsatisfying to just hear, don't bring firewood. You know, I'm sitting here listening going, come on, isn't there more we can do than that? And we did a whole program on these biocontrols, Jeff, so I'd love your thoughts too. So, Christian, thank you for raising that.
Sure. So there are basically three strategies for controlling the spread and the population density of this borer. One is quarantine, which we've already spoken about. The other is host resistance, which people are beginning to actively work on, which is the case with elm and chestnut. And the third prong strategy is exactly what was just said, biological control. So classical biological control is the seeking out and importation of natural enemies, in this case parasitoid wasps, from the native range of an insect, in this case Asia, in order for those insects to exert control, population suppression, on the insect that's a pest here in our borders. There actually have been four species of wasps that have been introduced across three genera. One is an egg parasitoid, so it lays its eggs inside the eggs of the emerald ash borer on the bark surface, and the other three are larval parasitoids, so they actually are able to find the larvae inside the tree and the wasps oviposit on the larvae inside the tree. So incidentally, the wasps are not stinging wasps. They've traded their stingers for ovipositors, which is the egg-laying organ. Sometimes people get nervous when they hear about releasing wasps.
Yeah, we're going to be importing a lot of wasps, folks.
Right,
so watch
exactly.
Out.
We have imported a lot of wasps.
I'm glad you mentioned that, yeah.
But they're very, very tiny, almost to the point of being microscopic, some of them, that you wouldn't even really necessarily see them if you'd think they were a tiny gnat or something.
So does it work, Jeff?
Well, so biological control has many examples of great successes. There have been some failures as well, especially in the early days when people weren't thinking so carefully about host specificity testing and being very careful about assessing the safety of releasing these things. But we like to believe we've gotten better since then, and there's extensive testing that takes place to make sure that these wasps are not going to affect our native insect fauna.
Are we doing biocontrols to protect these trees now in New Hampshire?
Right, yeah. So there have been four species that have been released, and one appears to be the most promising, and that's one that I actually study, which we can talk about.
All right. Coming up, we will definitely finish up with that conversation. We'll take a lot more of your calls, and we'll talk about the plight of the poor American chestnut. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at troubled trees, three species of trees important to our region, the elm, the ash, and the American chestnut. We're looking at the stresses they face and why it matters to the broader ecosystem. By the way, our producers put a great web post up on this with lots more information and pictures. So check it out, nhpr.org/exchange. Also, there are some pictures of the leaves and stems they brought into the studio. You can check them out on Instagram. It's NHPR Exchange. And as always, of course, you can give us a call right now at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, guys, just to circle back to the conversation we were having, and Jeff, I'll turn to you first. Lots of concern about the emerald ash borer, but some hope as New Hampshire and other states experiment with what are called biocontrols, in particular these teeny little wasps that go after the eggs or go after the larvae. How hopeful are you feeling that we might be able to save the ash tree?
Well, I think it's a worthwhile effort, and I think we should be as hopeful as we can be. But there are definitely challenges, and I think people should be cognizant of the fact that we're very likely going to lose most, if not all, of our large ash trees. So when the ash resource in this case is so devoid of resistance to a particular insect, and it's just like candy for them, and the populations build up to huge, huge numbers, staggering numbers, and when the populations are that high, they just sweep through and kill everything in their wake. But what we expect to happen after that killing front, if you want to call it that, is for the regeneration layer to come in. So the trees that were spared because they were too small or were living as seeds at the time of the initial infestation will then grow and age into susceptibility. And that's when we hope that biological control can really exert its primary forces. So first of all, we may have lost some of the most susceptible genotypes that were the first to die. So there's a bit of resistance in the lingering ash that we're seeing around. And then we exert top-down control using biological control. So the most effective one that we've, in terms of establishment and spread and percent parasitism, is one of the ways that we measure is called Tetrastichus planipinisi, is the species that I study. And that is particularly effective in small trees. It has a very short ovipositor, so they can't get through the bark of thick trees, but they seem to be fairly effective at protecting smaller trees. That means that we still need additional wasps or other control measures to control populations on larger trees.
And oh, wow. You need a whole different set of you know, samurai, so to speak.
Exactly. So having a suite of biological control agents that have different environmental requirements and different life stages that they attack, different parts of the tree, different ages of tree, is a much more effective strategy than relying on one alone.
Is there anything in the realm of the elm tree, Christian, that has a similar attack strategy? Is there a beetle or a bug or a worm or something that could go after Dutch elm disease?
So it's a little more complicated because you have an insect spreading the disease, but then the actual mortality comes from the fungal pathogen.
Right.
And early on, there were some strategies trying to control the beetle with biological controls, but there are some native beetles that spread it as well as exotic beetles.
I see, so that spread the fungus.
Yes, so there are several beetle species, which makes it more complicated. And it's enough for one beetle to go through and infect the tree. It doesn't have to, so even if you reduce the bark beetle population by 90%, say, those other 10% would still be able to spread the disease. So that didn't work out. So one could think about a control of the fungal pathogen. And that hasn't been fully explored. You know, maybe there are some viruses that live in tree phloem that could be used or engineered to be a defense. This idea isn't totally new in chestnut blight. There was, which affected European chestnut as well, there were some viruses that occurred naturally in some chestnuts in Italy, which then attacked the fungal pathogen and helped restore the chestnut population in Europe. So,
well, it's complicated based on what you just said and what Jeff just said. And it takes time to see if you're right or not, because trees, you know, unlike tomato plants, you know, they take a long time.
And you need a little luck too. So they're just, as you're searching for solutions, stumbling on those, you know, nature has all that complexity and we know so little about it. And as we explore, we come across potential solutions.
Go ahead, Jeff, and then Dave.
Right. I was just going to say, and Christian made the point briefly, but the fact that this fungal pathogen in the case of Dutch elm disease has been picked up by native beetles makes it much more complicated to control using biological control.
Right. You don't want to wipe out whole species of native beetles because as other species depend on those beetles.
Of course. And then the other problem with Dutch elm disease dementia is that it also spreads via root grafting. So once there's an infected tree, it can actually infect its neighbors through the root system because it gets into the vascular system of the tree and spreads underground to neighboring trees. So that's one of the problems with planting it at high density in a street tree situation as well.
I see. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, all these biological controls are basically building up a background level of these control agents that can take decades. Christian pointed out that the control for the gypsy moth in the took decades to become established before the virus kicked in that knocked back the gypsy moth population. And so people like to think of a quick fix like a sledgehammer, but you're really talking about kind of what population geneticists describe as a population bottleneck, where there's an initial killing that wipes out a huge number of the not resistant genotypes, as we were saying. And then over time, those that remain are the basis for restocking the population. But you're talking about centuries, not years or even decades.
Well, speaking of restocking the population, here's an email about the third tree that I wanted to talk to you guys about today, the American chestnut. Adam and Sandwich says, please be sure to discuss the efforts of the American Chestnut Foundation. They've spent three decades back crossbreeding with the blight-resistant Chinese chestnut to create a highly resistant tree, which is now nearly 100% pure American chestnut. At the same time, Adam says, affiliates and partners at the SUNY, that's the State University of New York, are working to delicately modify the American chestnut genome, enabling it to tolerate the fungus that would otherwise kill it. Adam says, I'm going to ask you this, Dave, I believe we were within a few human generations of seeing the American chestnut again flourish throughout the Northeast thanks to this work. Thank you, Adam, because I really did want to talk about this. This is a species, Dave, you know this better than I do, that was basically completely wiped out. I mean, you used to see them everywhere. Now you just see these little...
Well, there's still chestnuts growing in the forest, but they're not resistant.
I've seen them, but and they're tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, and I think it's right. I've been hearing the same thing, that we're a matter of decades away from, it's not going to be a matter of if, but a matter of when they're able to restore chestnut to the landscape. And there's two kind of competing schools that have been working on this. There's the American Chestnut Foundation's backcrossing process that's been going on for decades. And then there's also genetically modified by basically grafting a wheat gene that introduces resistance into the DNA.
Wait, wheat?
There is wheat.
As in bread wheat?
Yeah, there is resistant wheat gene that is resistant to the fungus that causes that chestnut. And so if you can graft that piece, I mean, we're talking about genetically modified GMO. You're talking about genetically modifying chestnut DNA to get the resistance from this particular gene in wheat and to integrate that into the DNA of the chestnut so it has resistance built in. And so you're literally in a petri dish working on undifferentiated parenchyma cells and inoculating that and introducing resistance that way versus decades of backcrossing. And so these two efforts are going on concurrently, and both or one of them will successfully introduce a fully resistant chestnut.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Right. Well, we hope so. So for sure, the American Chestnut Society has been working very hard for decades already and on backcross, or on taking genes from Chinese chestnut, which are resistant, and getting them into the American population. And once they do that, Chinese chestnut is actually an orchard tree. It's been bred for thousands of years by the Chinese. So some of the traits that are present in Chinese chestnut are not actually traits that we would want in our wild American chestnut. Plus, we want American chestnut. And so backcrossing with parents that are full bred American chestnuts is both desirable from sort of an aesthetic perspective, but also is going to allow them to survive in our diverse forests as well. But you need to keep the genes from the Chinese chestnut that confer resistance. So it's a pretty painstaking process. They're on, I think, generation 3 or 4. Now they're starting to intercross the different hybrids, which are about 15/16 American, 1/16 Chinese, mixing those genes together, taking the ones they like, backcrossing it again for probably another 2 generations with the American chestnut, and then they think they might be ready for deployment. Of course,
deployment. I like that word.
Right. Well, there's been a lot of work already with seed gardens and volunteer plantings across the United States that have sort of worked out some of the bugs in terms of how to effectively grow chestnut. It's not a trivial matter to, you know, replace billions and billions of trees across the landscape.
Adam, I'm so glad you sent us that email. Thank you. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Here's another email, and I'll throw this to you, Christian. This is from, person didn't give a name, but in Berlin. This person says, do elms live longer in the north? Are the beetles less active in the tree's northern range? I've seen some in the Dummer area above Berlin on Route 16, which are pretty big. Do you know about this? Are trees in the northern part of New England, Christian, doing better in general than the ones in the south?
Obviously, trees do better or worse in different climates as they are adapted to different environments. And the population density responds to that. So the abundance of the elm is greatest in the floodplain because that's where the nutrients are high and they love the high nutrients. And when you have, Jeff alluded to this with the urban trees, when you have a high population density, the pathogens and the bark beetles that spread the pathogen, they're going to have much more higher population density and you're much more likely to get infected. So if you're along a river as an elm, you're much more likely to get infected and much more likely to die. But if you're outside the historic elm habitat, like if you're were planted up on the top of a hill in the middle of a cemetery or in the middle of a pasture where there are no other elms around, you're not going to get infected because the bark beetles only fly so far. If you're more than 300 feet away from other elms, you're lucky enough, you probably won't get infected. Just like, you know, if we never go out during flu season, we're not going to get the flu.
We might be lonely, but we won't get the flu.
and so we see the same thing. A lot of the big survivors are in these isolated situations.
Sure, former pastures and mountaintops and so forth.
But occasionally we do find a big one in a floodplain where there's been lots of disease around them for decades. And those are potentially ones that have some genetic resistance. So our research looks for those trees, you know, trees that are over 3 feet diameter, lots of dead and dying elms around them, and then we test those for disease resistance and use them in the breeding program.
Okay, so last question, Dave. Silly question. Where do you go for your leaf peeping?
I'll go anywhere for my leaf peeping. I like the Sunapee region because that's where I live. Upper Valley, Monadnock region, following it from north to south. One thing I do want to say is there is a great website called NewHampshireBugs.org. That's an effort of the Division of Forests and Lands. If anybody's interested in hearing about or learning more about pests in New Hampshire, NewHampshireBugs.org. Just that simple.
Well, and also, again, our producers put up a fantastic web post. Lots and lots of links, information there as well. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Gentlemen, this was really interesting. We could have talked a lot longer. I really appreciate you coming in. Christian, thank you again for making the trip.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's Christian Marks, ecologist with the Nature Conservancy's Connecticut River Program. Jeff Garner, so good to meet you. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Jeff Garner, assistant professor of forest ecosystem health at UNH. And Dave Anderson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Laura.
Dave Anderson with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.